On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. All month, we've been talking about how food's having its moment on the screen, from TV shows set in restaurants to Netflix specials featuring the world's top chefs. We continue our Food on the Screen series with a look at the NBC reality TV show, The Biggest Loser. Some shocking findings from the New York Times revealed that most of the contestants on Season 8 regained much, if not all, the weight they lost. Some are even heavier now than they were at the start of the season. To hear why dieting is such a zero-sum game, or even worse, we called neuroscientist Sandra Amott. Her new book is Why Diets Make Us Fat. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
Before we get into our discussion, I want to play a clip from the most recent season of The Biggest Loser. We're going to hear the two finalists weighing in to find out who's the winner.
All right. This is it, everyone. All those workouts, challenges, and temptations come down to this one final moment. Either Steven or Roberto will win the grand prize of $250,000 and the title of The Biggest Loser. And one of those trainers is gonna get a whole lot of street cred right now. Roberto.
Let's load the wagon, Bob.
Let's load the wagon. All right, when you first started The Biggest Loser, you weighed 348 pounds. In order for you to beat Steven and win the grand prize and title of The Biggest Loser, you need to have lost 150 pounds or more. Your current weight is 160 pounds. You're the biggest loser, Roberto! Yes!
Wow. When you hear that, does it sort of break your heart?
It does.
Given the abysmal track record of Biggest Loser contestants to keep the weight off, one wonders if they even have to sign something acknowledging that that might happen to them. Do you know if that's the case?
I don't know. I should point out, though, that the Biggest Loser contestants, having gained back only 70% of their lost weight in 6 years, is one of the best results that has ever been seen in long-term weight loss.
Let's break that down. So you're saying even though a contestant who lost 150 pounds has gained back 70% after 6 years, that's still considered success?
I don't know if that person would consider it success, but if you look at actual studies of long-term weight loss, that's a very unusually good result. In most studies, virtually everybody would have gained back all but maybe 5 pounds of their lost weight at that point.
Wow. I wonder if most of the people watching the show have any idea. I would imagine not.
No, I think everybody tends to focus on what happens right after a diet. And it's hard to think about what happens 5 years later. That's not really the way that we're inclined to consider things.
And when I think about those contestants, I think about how much more supported they are than dieters, just regular people out there in the world dieting all on their own.
Yeah. So the best long-term diet results in the medical literature is something called the Look-Ahead Study, where they managed to get about a quarter of the people who went on a diet to lose 10% of their weight and keep it off for almost 10 years. And in order to do that, each participant in the study had over 300 contacts with nutritionists, with exercise specialists, with clinical psychologists. A quarter of their participants also ended the 10-year period weighing more than they had when they started. That's as good as it gets, and that's how much work it takes.
Wow.
To keep weight off in the long term.
So fascinating.
Those contestants are not by far the only people who've been fooled by short-term success on diets. Most of us are.
Could you give us some statistics? How many folks who lose weight end up gaining it all back?
It depends on how much weight they lose and how long you insist on them keeping it off to call it a success. But in general, it's a percentage in the single digits somewhere, less than 10%. More worryingly, about 40% of people who lose weight on a diet end up gaining back more than they lost.
Is this just because by our very nature, we're all slackers? We can't hold on to that intense willpower and control for all that time?
It's certainly true that willpower was not meant to be a long-term solution to these kinds of problems, but the problem goes deeper than that. We actually have a brain system that has evolved for the purpose of keeping us from losing too much weight. If you think about it, over the human history, overeating has been a problem for a few decades. Starvation, on the other hand, has been a problem for at least 200,000 years, maybe longer. And our brains really have not caught up to the modern world where obesity is more likely than starvation. It never has been before.
What happens to the typical dieter who starts out at a normal weight?
A typical dieter will lose about 6% of their weight 6 months or so out from the start of the diet. And for an average person, that is as thin as they will ever get. And then they slowly regain the weight, hitting their previous pre-diet weight at about 4 or 5 years out.
Wow, 4 or 5 years out. The people that we know who are success stories, who maybe lost 60 pounds in their 30s or 40s, and in their 60s, they are still that same weight. Are they just completely self-monitoring constantly?
That's a lot of the story. Of course, these people who keep weight off for years and years have been studied extensively. It's worth pointing out that they were not randomly selected. We find them after the fact, which means that it's quite likely that there's something special about them that isn't shared by the rest of us. Maybe they do have unusually amazing willpower. But what typically is found about people like that is that they stay on a diet for the rest of their life. They are continually monitoring their calories. They exercise about an hour a day. A lot of them turn out to be fitness professionals who have actually made sustaining their weight loss into their career.
Wow. How does the brain fight against weight loss? What is the mechanism at work?
So if you get below what scientists call your defended range, or you probably know better as your set point, which is a range of about 10 or 15 pounds, and this system kicks in, you got to get that weight back. What happens is, first of all, that you get much hungrier. Food actually becomes more rewarding. Most frighteningly, the thing you can't do anything about is that your metabolism will drop so that your body actually burns less energy. So you end up turning from, you know, a Humvee into a Prius. You actually become more fuel efficient when you're underweight. Underweight for you, not underweight in any absolute sense.
For years, heavy people have been saying this, that the more I lose, the harder it is to lose, and the fewer calories I need to eat. And I think people who don't have this problem never really believed us.
Yeah, I think that's true. And The Biggest Loser is by far the best study we've had on this because they actually were able to measure people's metabolism before and right after the show, and then again 6 years later. But there have been previous studies that have shown that as long as 6 years after a diet, people are still metabolically suppressed.
thinking about it not from a caloric intake way, but from a metabolic way, is there a way to rev up the metabolism so that it's less about controlling calories?
There isn't a good way to increase metabolism. Everybody says, oh, well, you just got to get in shape because muscles burn more calories than fat. And that's true, but it's a very small effect. Most of the calories that we burn at rest have to do with our postural muscles, the muscles in your back and belly that hold you upright, not in your biceps or the kinds of muscles that people train when they lift weights or exercise a lot.
It's interesting. In your book, you even talk about as the metabolism slows, the body does things like, for example, you fidget less.
Mm-hmm. And again, if you think of this in an evolutionary sense, imagine that you are living out in the wild somewhere and you have to walk around the forest and find food. Then if you start to lose weight, it's probably because there's no food available around where you are. And being able to burn less energy while you're traveling to try to find more food and not wasting energy by doing unnecessary movement when you're not out looking for food, all of that stuff sounds like a very, very sensible solution. It's just a very sensible solution to a problem that most of us don't have anymore.
What about this idea that it's not only humans that have gotten bigger, but there might be some sort of chemical implication to animals getting bigger as well?
Yeah, those are interesting data. Almost every species of animal that lives in contact with humans has also gotten heavier over the last couple of decades. And that includes even laboratory animals. It's also wild animals. And one possibility is simply that our food supply, which is high in calories and low in nutrients, is spilling over. You know, the rats are going in the trash can and the same big food companies are making the laboratory animal chow that are making some of our food. But another possibility is that there is some kind of an environmental pollutant that is raising the set point and causing people and other animals to become heavier. We don't know yet.
Given this idea about dieting being just a complete zero-sum game or worse, how does one approach teaching, for example, a preteen girl about this? Because we tend to start worrying about weight and dieting when we have absolutely no need.
Yeah, most people get started dieting when they're teenagers, and most people are not very heavy when they start dieting. I think we're grabbing this problem completely by the wrong end. We're focusing our efforts on what's most difficult to change, our weight, when we know that there are many, many positive gains that we could get from focusing on easier stuff like increasing our exercise, eating more vegetables, getting more fiber, eating whole foods instead of processed foods. In fact, programs that teach teenagers to do things like that without mentioning weight, without getting them all worked up over what they weigh, in long-term, two-year follow-up, those kids gain less weight than the kids who didn't get that kind of education.
I understand that you yourself don't weigh yourself anymore.
Nope. I have not stepped on a scale and seen the number for over 6 years now.
What made you decide to do that?
Well, that was a consequence of my long-term history of yo-yo dieting. I spent about 30 years, starting at the age of 13, losing the same 15 pounds over and over and over again. I was just set up to care far too much about my weight. For me, the easiest way not to worry about my weight is not to know it. If I had gotten the kind of intervention that I'm hoping other teenage girls get when I was younger, it probably wouldn't be such an issue.
How do you deal with your eating as a person who has gone through this yourself?
So I am now using that brain system that keeps my weight near my set point deliberately. I'm letting that run my weight. I am practicing mindful eating, which means that I eat when I'm hungry and I try not to eat when I'm not hungry. If you do that, your weight will settle at your set point and stay there without any additional effort. What's great about that compared to using willpower is that I don't have to think about it all the time. It doesn't require any effort. My weight just stays where it wants to be. I don't worry about it.
Yeah, the amount of mental energy it takes to monitor yourself is staggering. I think a lot of people who don't experience it have no idea the interminable conversation that goes on in your brain.
Yeah, and the thing is that it goes on every waking minute, right? You can't just say, oh, okay, I've decided not to eat that donut. You're sitting in the meeting, the plate of donuts is there. You decide not to eat that donut. 30 seconds later, you again decide not to eat that donut. 2 minutes after that, you again decide not to eat that donut. And if you make that decision 50 times during the meeting, and then on the 51st try, you reach for it and you eat it, all that other willpower was wasted. It didn't do you any good at all.
I wish there was a magic pill.
Everybody wishes there was a magic pill. We may have one someday, but it's not coming anytime soon, I can tell you that. Certainly none of the pills we have now are magic.
These days, we're starting to see more media coverage about body positive images. Do you think that there is starting to be a shift?
I hope so. More and more people are coming to understand that being worried about your body is actually a predictor of long-term weight gain. So it's actively counterproductive to try to make people ashamed of their bodies. And it's not motivating. It actually makes things worse. So I hope that the word is getting out.
That was Sandra Amett, author of Why Diets Make Us Fat. If you listen to This American Life, either on the radio or podcasting, be sure not to miss last Sunday's show on fat shaming. We'll also have a link for you on our website. Last week, we talked to Chef Nikki Nakayama about how the Netflix series Chef's Table changed her life forever. When season one started streaming, she couldn't take reservations at a restaurant and Naka fast enough. Now we turn to another chef about to take this ride. Adeline Gretard runs Yamcha in Paris, and she'll be featured on the next season of Chef's Table. Hi, Adeline.
Hello.
What did you think when Netflix first approached you about being featured on Chef's Table?
I was very surprised they asked me to do something with them. When I accept to do it, I didn't realize how long we will spend in the restaurant. All the team spent 10 days filming all the time, making very long interview. I had to give a lot, but at the end, I was so happy to do it. I really love the director, Michael, Andrew, the filmmaker, and it was an incredible experience.
Some chefs that I've spoken to say that really it's the first opportunity they've had to digest the arc of their own professional life.
Yes, they wanted to know a lot. Maybe because I'm a woman chef, maybe. They wanted to know how I became cook, how I built my concept, and I had to tell a lot about my life.
I think that's what makes the series so engaging. For a lot of people, talented chefs are as mysterious as really talented actors. And and when you get to hear the deep backstory, it makes the final product you see on your plate more understandable.
Yes, exactly. They need to know you. They need to know a lot about you. Almost 1 year ago, we made the film. And now I understand why they stay so long time, why they ask so much. But I'm sure at the end, it won't be about my personal life. It will be about my style, about my vision from the kitchen.
Now, your restaurant, Yamcha, is a 14-table restaurant in Les Halles. Did they just completely take over the space? Were you doing business?
Oh, yes. The restaurant was normally open, as usual. They didn't disturb us. They were here, but we continue to do our business.
And I understand that the crew even followed you to Hong Kong, which is a big part of your story.
Exactly. We spent 4 days in Hong Kong together, and it was great because it was 6 months after Paris. Netflix Chef's Table, was really happy to film in Hong Kong because it was the third time for them. And me, I was very happy to be back in Hong Kong. It made something, like magic.
At Yum Cha, your restaurant, you serve French Hong Kong cuisine, and you change the menu, not just seasonally or daily, but every single meal, which sounds incredibly stressful to me. How do you pull it together before the doors open?
It's not stressful for me. It's a choice. I like cooking at home. I buy the best produce. And then I decide the menu. And each time I buy small quantities because exceptional produce are not sold, in big and huge quantities, means each shift is different.
You call yourself a cook, not a chef. Why?
I like cooking with the wok. I like seasoning myself. I'm bad to teach because I really enjoy this part, to do it myself. I want to cook for the people who come to my home, to my restaurant. My restaurant is my home.
Here in the United States, it's so rare to find women working as chefs in restaurant kitchens. And when you do find them, often they're pastry chefs. But the only man working in your kitchen at Yum Cha is a pastry chef.
Yes, I can understand your point of view because often in France it is the same. The pastry section is often female. I met this guy, Adrien, and I had a good feeling. I was sure he can drive my idea, he can realize with his technique the dessert I wanted in my restaurant.
Why do you think that no man applied to work with you? Do you think there's still that barrier in French kitchens?
Maybe they think I'm not good enough. I don't know. No, I don't know. Really, I don't know. I had only women applying. I'm not sad. It makes a woman team, a female team. So I like it very much, and I enjoy. Why men don't want to work with me, I have no idea. Maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe they are scared. I don't know.
The French palate of eaters has been famously resistant for so many years to any change of seasoning. And yet you're having tremendous success. Is your clientele primarily French?
I can tell we have 50% of Parisian people and 50% people of from all the world visiting Yum Cha. 50-50, I would say.
What do you think of all of these portrayals of food on the screen? Do you think it has changed the way people are eating and cooking in France?
I think it has changed a lot. Cooking and the restaurant world, people are more interested in food. They are also very interested on a reality show. I'm not sure I can share this point of view because I'm not so fan about this. The movement.
It could be just a passing trend.
Yes, exactly. A lot of restaurants opening because you do a TV reality show. It's easier to have the finance to open your own restaurant. But I don't think it's the best solution.
The episode of Chef's Table in which you're featured is going to be released in September. But has life already changed for you?
Not at all. Nothing has changed for me for the moment. And Yum Cha will stay always Yum Cha. And I really love Chef's Table, and I'm sure the episode will be great. I will try to stay myself and doing my work as best as possible.
Well, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule.
No, thank you. Thank you to you.
That's Adeline Gretard. She'll be featured in the third season of Chef's Table, along with three other French chefs, Alain Passard, Michel Trois-Gros, and Alexandre Coulion. Next, we find out where to play Food Fight, drink a beer, and eat great Vietnamese food. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
You go there and it doesn't even look like a restaurant. It looks like a video arcade. It is a video arcade.
That's our very own Jonathan Gold. He's talking about Button Mash in Echo Park.
The video games, which come out of the rotating collection, take up almost all the restaurant.
What kind of video games?
The video games that were popular when you used to play video games, probably. Which is to say, you know, Frogger and Space Invaders.
Galaga.
Oh, boy, is there Galaga. Usually a line for the Galaga machine.
Isn't that funny? Can people take food to the games?
I think taking food to the games would be frowned on, but you can bring drinks to the games. A lot of them have even like little tables and platforms next to them so you can drink craft beer and play Food Fight.
Who's doing the food there?
Wintron and T-Tron, who we know from Starry Kitchen.
It's such the perfect environment for them.
It's so good. It's the kind of place where Win can show up in his banana suit and he's not even out of place.
So for people who somehow missed the Starry Kitchen juggernaut that moved from place to place to place for so long, give us a heads up on the kind of food they've been doing and whether or not there's anything new at Button Mash.
Starry Kitchen is among the original pop-ups in L.A. It started in the apartment courtyard of T and Win. In the Valley. It had the highest rating of any Asian restaurant in Los Angeles on Yelp. They went into what I could swear was a converted Carl's Jr. for a while in a downtown food court. They took over nighttimes at one of Fred Eric's restaurants for a while, and they spent a long time in the center of Chinatown taking over the kitchen in a bar called the Grand Star.
And then they resurfaced in this sort of strange, fantastic environment.
Right.
Okay, so let's get to the food. What did you enjoy when you were there?
They've always been famous for the tofu balls, to the point where, you know, Win is famous for his signs that said, put our balls in your mouth. I think he even got Mayor Villaraigosa to pose by that sign at once.
Very persuasive fellow.
That's like a green, like, risotto thing that's wrapped around tofu and fried, and it's delicious, and it's vegan, and everybody eats it. There's a small specialty in chicken wings, double fried in the Korean fashion, so they're super spicy. One of them is flavored with tamarind, and it's really sour. There's one that's flavored with gochujang, the Korean chili fermented bean paste. Those are obviously good with beer. They have some more serious dishes, which sometimes seems incongruous. You know, you think you're going to spend the entire time eating the mac and cheese with bacon or the shrimp toast or the tiny roast peanuts with fermented tofu. But they do a sort of intriguing version of popia, which is a spring roll, Indonesian, Malaysia, you see it. In this version, which is very close to the Vietnamese version, it's a party food. So they bring out rice paper, those dry rounds. There's a little thing of water that you moisten it in, and then you pile in carrots or fried tofu or bean sprouts or pickles, bits of egg, herbs. You wrap it up and you eat it like an egg roll. Kind of good.
I do not have good luck with those dry rice pancakes and the water. You have to be quicker than you imagine.
You just twirl the rice paper through the water once, very quickly, and then you put it down, and then it softens. If you imagine that it has to soften in the water, then it will fall apart or become super gummy and unpleasant.
Very good advice. Thank you.
You're welcome. And one of the other things that I like there a lot is their version of bún cha Hanoi.
What is that?
Bún cha Hanoi is a dish that's become actually famous lately. When President Obama went to Vietnam, he had lunch at a noodle shop with Anthony Bourdain. The shop specialized in bún cha Hanoi, which is a specialty of vermicelli noodles, grilled pork, and grilled pork patties that have been soaking in sort of a sugared fish sauce, and then a big platter of herbs. You assemble it and you eat it. It's another great party dish.
Well, that sounds really fantastic.
The San Gabriel Valley is a really good place to find bún cha Hanoi. I've been going to a few places lately, of which I'll never pronounce this right. I think it's Woon, though it's spelled N-G-O-O-N, has a really nice version. I really like the version of Brodard in Little Saigon. There's a few other places that have it. The version at Button Mash is not the most serious version in town, but it's really delicious. And you can't go to Brodard and play Space Invaders.
That's so true. What about their famous Singaporean crab dish?
They don't have that chili crab, and I think everybody who goes there asks about it. But they do have a few of the noodle dishes that are famous from Starry Kitchen, including their version of dan dan mian, the sort of spicy noodles tossed with pork, and a bibimguksu, which is a Korean-style dish of noodles that are tossed with vegetables and bean sauce. They use, I'm almost sure, those fresh Japanese ramen noodles from Sun Noodle, which is a really good noodle. So that gives it a nice edge up on some of the versions in town. And the desserts are good. I mean, you'd expect the desserts to be good. You'd expect the fries to be good. There's the Herculean challenge of the brick toast, which is as thick as an encyclopedia. It includes peanut butter, Nutella, ice cream, fried bananas, and a bunch of other stuff. But I kind of go for the almond tofu and soy milk.
Yeah, she's really, really talented.
Yeah. I don't know how long this is going to be around, but it seems like it'll be there for a while.
There are lines.
There are lines, especially late at night. Buy a lot of tokens.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Button Mash in Echo Park. Go to our website to learn how to roll up that popia Jonathan likes. And text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. Clearly, most of what we talk about on this show is the food eaten by we humans. But if you live in a big city, you might wonder about what coyotes are eating. Maybe you've seen these wily predators skulking the streets at dusk and dawn. In some parts of the country, including right here in LA, the drought has brought them out of the mountains and canyons and onto our blocks in search of food and water. KCRW's Avishai Artsy has the scoop.
There are those of us who think coyotes are a menace to society. They lie in wait until we take our eyes off our cats and small dogs, then they strike. Others are fans of these resourceful predators and advocate for their survival, like Melanie Simmons, who keeps chickens.
Chickens are delicious to coyotes, and I've lost more than I'd like to admit to those that have come through the yard. They've earned their trickster name, as far as I can say from my own experience.
Simmons closes up her chicken coop at night and keeps a close watch on the flock. Still, when the occasional hen is lost to a predator, she doesn't hold it against them. In fact, Simmons believes we should be grateful.
People don't like to have certain vermin around, and rats and mice and so on, and they actually do a tremendous job to keep the numbers of rodents in check.
Simmons has been a docent at Pasadena's Eaton Canyon Nature Center for 18 years. When the National Park Service started recruiting people like her for a study on the diet of coyotes, she jumped at the chance to start collecting coyote droppings. On a recent Saturday morning, about 30 volunteers gathered at the Audubon Center in Debs Park. They huddled around a table to look at bowls of dried poop, bobcat and coyote.
What I would do if I saw this on the trail is I would break it in half.
Okay, so I'm going to do that. I see a little twist.
So let's break it in half.
Okay, there's stuff.
So that's pretty much entirely fur.
Okay.
So I would collect that.
Binta Wold helps run the Urban Coyote Project for the National Park Service. She says one way to tell the different kinds of scat apart is by the shape. Bobcat poop, for example, is shaped like a ball and socket joint.
Often coyote scat has a characteristic twisted appearance. They're a little bit smaller than dog scat usually. If you have a scat that you think is coyote, it'll probably have bones or fur or seeds. They're omnivores, so they eat a lot of fruits and berries and things like that. And then occasionally also, especially in urban environments, there will be anthropogenic materials. So things like paper towels, food wrappers, barbecue chicken we saw once. So yeah, a great diversity of different foods.
Justin Brown, a biologist for Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area, has hard evidence that people are feeding wild animals.
I've seen several different occasions where they're putting either food from their lunch out in an area, and you can see the coyotes keep coming back. I've actually put cameras on some of those, and you see possums, skunks, raccoons, coyotes all eating from these piles. But then also people are putting plates of dog food out as well.
Animal control is trying to crack down on the active feeding of wildlife. It's illegal, and Wold is concerned it could lead to more hungry coyotes that aren't shy about approaching people.
If people do get bitten by coyotes, that's often one of the reasons we think why they get bitten is because those coyotes had been fed before.
It's worth noting that these cases are incredibly rare. Only a dozen coyote bites are reported each year in the U.S. Compare that to 4.7 million plus dog bites.
If you want to help wild animals, it's a good idea to just keep your distance from them and, you know, respect them from a distance, and definitely don't feed them or leave anything out in your yard that could be a food source for wild animals.
The goal of the Park Service study is to inform residents and elected officials about coyote behavior, dietary and otherwise, when it's time to make decisions about how to keep them out of urban areas. Some cities have approved measures to trap and kill coyotes roaming the streets, but Randy Feilish's group Project Coyote lobbies for more humane measures.
They're probably the most persecuted predator. You know, if they're not killed by inhumane trapping or illegal hunting or being hit by cars, you know, they're being poisoned regularly by anticoagulant rodenticides, you know, rat poison. And that's also what's killing off, you know, our owls, our bobcats, our hawks, our mountain lions.
Back at the Audubon Center in Debs Park, the volunteers split up into groups and fan out to parks, cemeteries, and golf courses in search of coyote scat. One team heads to Rio de Los Angeles State Park. They slowly make their way along the dusty trail, scanning the ground for droppings. When some scat is sighted, biologist Justin Brown bends down to scoop it up. With latex-gloved hands, he carefully places the poop into a paper bag. The bag is labeled with a marker. Then they continue walking the trail.
You'll see all these little things that are kind of jagged in shape. Sometimes you'll see little tiny seeds, but they're usually more uniform in shape, where if they've been eaten all 100% of something like Pedigree or Alpo or something, there'll be all these little pieces of cracked corn in them.
Eventually, the Park Service will run genetic tests on all the droppings they collect. A lot of it will probably come from pet dogs, but Brown hopes there will be animal remnants in at least some of the scat they find.
When you go to start actually looking at these scats, one little piece might make a big difference, especially if there's a bone, a tooth. Teeth are the most important part, so if you see something that has a tooth in it, make sure you grab that.
This may sound like pretty esoteric stuff, but when the Park Service announced its coyote scat survey, 180 volunteers applied to help. 30 were selected for the scat gathering phase. One of them was Mary D. Donnan, who lives in Beverly Glen near Stone Canyon Reservoir. Donnan hears the coyotes howl at night. Some of her neighbors have lost cats recently.
What I've read, that a very small percentage of coyotes' diets is cat or pet. The random cat that goes missing, everybody wants to blame the poor coyote, and it's not fair. I think the more we know about them, the more we might appreciate them as part of our urban environment and our wildlife.
It will be a little while longer before we can say definitively what coyotes are eating, at least here in LA. First, the volunteers must collect a lot more poop. For the next few weeks, they'll be scanning the grounds of 30 different locations, from Griffith Park and Beverly Hills to Boyle Heights and Highland Park. Then, when the scat survey is completed, another team of volunteers will work with scientists to dry, sterilize, and sort the samples before running genetic tests. The Park Service expects to have the coyote scat survey results in 2018. For KCRW's Good Food, I'm Avishai Artsy.
Learn more about what coyotes are eating on the Good Food website. In a minute, it's back to the food that we humans are eating. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's finally summer here in California, so let's find out what's up for grabs at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I am talking right now with Ken Takayama, who is the chef de cuisine at Melisse Restaurant right here in Santa Monica. Ken has been cooking there for many, many years. He is coming to the market on a weekly basis with his team. And Ken, tell us what you're shopping for today.
Today we found some very beautiful zucchini blossoms, and we're planning on making, it's a play on ratatouille. What we do is we soft poach eggs in a shell, and then we peel the shell off, and we stuff the zucchini blossoms with the egg, just so that the egg gets fully covered with the yellow and green color. We lightly bread it with breadcrumbs, and then we deep fry it. The reason why we only lightly bread it is so that the flour shows. So the finished product, it looks like a zucchini blossom that's been fried.
We're just hitting the top layer of this dish right now. Can you just walk us through a little bit? And let's all remember, this is a 2-star Michelin restaurant, and this is like stuff nobody else does.
Okay, so first of all, I'm going to explain from the bottom of the plate. We get Chinese eggplants from Fresno Evergreen. We char it until it's completely blackened, and we make a puree out of it. And then sitting on top of that is ratatouille. We slice green zucchini, or yellow squash, the same Chinese eggplants. And we also use oven-dried tomatoes. And we shingle them standing up against the ring mold. And we bake the ratatouille off. And then we put the stuffed egg, the zucchini flour egg, on top of the ratatouille. For the sauce, we make a green tomato and garlic sauce. The green tomatoes we also get from Valdivia Farms. We use a touch of almond milk. And we also make a red bell pepper reduction. The red bell peppers we also get from Fresno Evergreen. We juice it and reduce it down really, really slowly to get the sweet element or the sweet component for the dish. Everything gets sauce table side, and then once the guest cracks open the egg, it's a surprise because the yolk starts running out, and once everything's incorporated together, it's delicious.
Do you work as a team in the kitchen to come up with these things?
Oh, every time, yes. Every time. We always talk about it when we're walking through the market. What can we do with this? We want to keep the original integrity of whatever we buy, you know, at its best. We don't want to mess it up. That's our philosophy. If we don't have to cook it in order to serve it perfectly, then we won't cook it.
All right, well, this is amazing to think that 10 blocks from this farmer's market, this is all happening on a daily basis. So, Ken, thank you so much.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ken Takayama. He is a chef de cuisine at Melisse. He works clearly with a great crew, a lot of inspired people, and he's at the market every single week. Squash blossoms are the flowers of a zucchini plant, and they're actually pretty hard to grow. And Casey Ritchie is here, and she sells squash blossoms for Green Farm, Life's a Choke. Casey, you seem to have squash blossoms most of the time. Can you tell us what kind of a plant they come from and how you grow them and how you get them here in such beautiful, pristine shape?
Well, we did actually have a bit of a lull in production because we had a little problem with the planting. Perhaps maybe being a little overwatered, and the weather in combination with that did stop us for some time, but now we're coming back into it. Our plan is that we have several plants in the greenhouse so that they're not affected as much by weather. And then we planted several in open field. And so the idea is that we're staggering the planting so that when they're coming up, we have trying to make it just enough. As you know, in Lompoc is predominantly not too hot, not too cold, perfect sandy soil. So all of those elements tend to work with us, although this last year the extra heat has been impeding our progress.
So these are baby green zucchinis, right?
Yes, we call them squash blossoms. I'm not quite sure why that is, when in fact, if you pick off the zucchini, it is a baby zucchini.
And for those people who haven't seen them, they've got very long, very, very delicate leaves, more delicate than tissue paper. And they always come in this gorgeous, pristine condition. How do you do that?
So we just pack them in one box that fits them where they fit just snugly. It comes to 120 pieces into one box, and they're packed and then immediately put in the cooler. And still, they're only going to last 3 days that way, so we bring them the day after we cut them.
How old is the plant when you have to harvest that blossom?
Once they were planted properly and then taken care of properly and watered the right amount at the right time and watched very carefully, took them about 3 weeks.
When I think of a zucchini plant, it's a great big spreading plant with huge leaves all over the place. And so when you are harvesting and you're just walking up and down the row and finding them right at that stage, how many do you harvest off of one plant?
We're probably going to take 2 to 5 off of a plant per picking. And then in a few more days, we probably will have a few more come off of that plant.
Does the blossom taste like a zucchini?
To me, it doesn't. It's just the best tasting edible flower I've ever had. It doesn't have a huge taste to it. It's just the way that it's complemented with cheese or whatever the dip is. But I personally use so many of them that I bake them so that I'm not doing the frying aspect.
Is the zucchini blossom one of your top selling items?
It is, keeping in mind that there is the storage and how long they're going to last. So we are limited on how many we can sell at once because you can only use so many at once.
And you go to the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday Santa Monica, what other, Hollywood?
In LA, that's about it right now. We're going to Ojai on Sundays, and we're in Santa Barbara on Tuesdays and Saturdays, as well as some of the San Luis Obispo markets.
Okay, well, we're so glad to have you here, Casey. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
That was Casey Ritchie. She sells with Green Farm, also called Life's a Choke. And Green is also very well known for their asparagus, artichokes, cauliflower, everything delicious, and it all goes great with cheese. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find that recipe for ratatouille with zucchini blossoms on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Earlier this month, more than 100 vendors served their best tacos to adoring fans in downtown LA. That day, celebrating all things taco, was Tacolandia. Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and host of KCRW's Orange County Line, was one of the festival judges this year.
Oh my God, it was like taco heaven. It was somewhere over 120, maybe even 150 tacos from literally all over the world, not just from San Diego and Southern California and Orange County, but we had stuff from Baja California, from Ensenada, from Nuevo León, and there was even a taco from London, which wasn't bad at all.
Did you have to eat every single taco?
I did not. I actually could have, but we had 3 categories that we had to judge. We had best street taco, best traditional taco, and then best in taco innovation. So our judges, I think there were about 12 of us. I split everyone up into groups, and then I split everything up into manageable things, kind of like what we did with the pie contest, you know, for KCRW. And then after that, I had them take off. And then I made every group whittle down their top 2. And then from there, we all together ended up eating like the final round, which is about 12 tacos. But in the meanwhile, also afterwards, I ate other tacos that weren't on my list and other ones that wasn't on the list, period.
Okay, let's talk about which were some of your favorites in each of those groups.
Oh my God. At the end, I think I might have eaten at least 31 tacos.
Oh, I'm so impressed. I had 5.
It became one big blurb. But all that said, you could still remember the great ones. And at least in Taco Innovation, there was an extraordinary taco made by Balam Tacos in Linwood. And a lot of people were surprised. Wait, there's a high-end Mexican eatery in Linwood, and it was amazing. So it was called, what was it called? It was like the Caribbean Atomic Bomb, I believe it was called. And first of all, the thing that's so striking about it is you see it, and it's crimson red. And their quote-unquote tortilla is actually a slice of jicama that had been treated overnight in Jamaica, agua de Jamaica, and hibiscus juice.
Wow, that's incredible.
And so you think at first, oh God, here's another vegan heresy. But no, it not only was that jicama tortilla pliant, like you were able to bend it like a taco and it maintained its integrity, but it was also crisp and with the Jamaica flavor. Oh my God, there was just a tartness to it. And then once you get over that tortilla, then you get to the actual taco itself. So it was coconut shrimp with this perfect batter, some mango salsa. But what really made it so great, in addition to all of that, was they made their own salsa de yahualica. Yahualica is this famous city in Jalisco that's famous for their chile de árbol. So think of a darker, spicier, and more burning tapatio. And that's what salsa guayalica is.
Wow. I can tell that this conversation
is kind of going to torture me, but I will soldier on. So what was the next category?
So next we had a best traditional taco, and that one was ruthless. That's where you have like your classics, like El Guerrerense. That's where you have tacos puntas cabras, coney seafood, a lot of the favorites in Los Angeles and Southern California. The two that really stuck out to me was Taco Maria from Orange County, from Costa Mesa. Carlos Salgado not only made his own blue corn tortillas from Heritage Blue Corn Maíz from Estado de Mexico, and that was just an amazing tortilla in and of itself. But then you had the inside. It was a sturgeon taco. So he had sustainably raised sturgeon meat, and he prepared it with, in Mexico, you call it a salsa rusa, but here we call it Thousand Island dressing. So, you know, smoky, tart, sweet, and then, of course, the earthiness of that blue corn tortilla was just absolutely awesome.
That was my favorite, hands down, that taco.
It was great. And the sturgeon taco, it's an off-menu item at Taco Maria. And sometimes he has it, sometimes he doesn't. It depends on whether he has the meat. But yeah, I mean, that really shows what an extraordinary chef Carlos is. But the winner in the traditional taco category, it was actually an upset. It was a place I had never been to before. It's called La Calaca Fish Tacos. And it's right now, they don't have a storefront. They just secured a lease at the Coliseum to be able to serve during Rams games. And they also have a car at the Coliseum during USC football games. They use tilapia for their fish, a great slop, but the fish batter, it was, you know, one of the best batters in a taco I'd ever had before for fish.
Wow.
Fluffy, crunchy, sweet. And then the topper was a salsa de cacahuate. So imagine a peanut butter in salsa form, and that's exactly what salsa de cacahuate is.
So good. Okay, next category.
The one that got the big Vendi Cup, because the Vendi Awards were sponsoring all of this, was Burritos La Palma. And it actually came down to two tacos. The one who came out in second place was Tacos Tamix. Let's see, if you went through a vendor's entrance there near La Placita Olvera, there was this humongous spit of al pastor. And I actually put it on my Instagram account. The taquero, he'd slice off a little bit for one taco. And then, like, you know, he would nick off a little piece of pineapple that was above his head. And the pineapple would fall perfectly onto his tortilla. And it was a great al pastor. It really was. And Burrito La Palma proved to be the eventual winner, and not without a bit of controversy. The first question, of course, everyone asked is, wait a minute, how is a burrito a taco? But for that, you know, you have to cede all authority to the tacorazo who curated the event, Bill Esparza, and he says, hey, the burrito is a regional form of taco in northern Mexico, so if I say it's a taco, it's a taco.
Well, thank you so much, Gustavo. As always, it was a pleasure.
Gracias, Evan.
You can see the paltry amount that we tried at Tacolandia on our Instagram feed. Just search for KCRW Good Food. We close out the show at a new food and crafts fair that started in Brooklyn, New York, and has now come to Los Angeles. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Smorgasburg, the weekly Brooklyn-based festival of food and crafts, has spawned several food innovations. Think ramen burger, where crunchy noodles take the place of the bun. Earlier this year, the founders decided LA merited its own smorgasburg. Naturally, food enthusiasts are excited, but it's the vendors who did somersaults. It's an opportunity for many talented folks who still don't have brick-and-mortar establishments to share their stuff. Zach Brooks of Midtown Lunch is the market manager. He's curating all that goodness. Hi there.
Hi.
So what's it like being a carpetbagger in your own town? I'm just kidding.
That's awesome. It's funny. People are like, that seems like it'd be a dream job for you. And I'm like, yeah, It kind of is. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because all you have to do is go around and taste people's stuff and see if they merit.
That's all that the job is. It was not hard. I'm not going to sit here and complain that I had to go around and eat all this great food and stuff. I mean, it's cool. What's really great about it is, I mean, like you said, Smorgasburg is, you know, in New York, it's always been this sort of place where, you know, new and up and coming concepts could sort of come. And like, you know, it's always this great like meeting place for people to kind of come and see like what's happening in New York. And so it's going to be here exactly what it was in New York, which is a great representation of like what's happening in LA right now in the food world.
So describe what Smorgasburg actually is.
The original market, which was founded by Jonathan Butler and Eric Demby, was called the Brooklyn Flea, which was sort of like a hipster flea market. I say that with quotes. I mean, it was a flea market with stuff like antiques and furniture and a little bit of food there. And at some point, the food became so popular that they spun it off into its own thing called Smorgasburg, which is all food.
The LA version's in a pretty great location, too.
Yeah, it's on Alameda between 7th and 8th in the Alameda Produce Market, which is like this 100-year-old. The whole area, you know, with all these buildings and the produce market is a very historic site. The buildings have been there for, you know, 100 years. The produce market is open Monday through Friday, but they're not open on Saturdays and Sundays. So we're going to be setting up on Sundays on the pavement in between their stalls.
Is there an entry fee?
No, it's totally free.
That's awesome.
And the parking lot's free for 2 hours as well. Did I mention how excited I am about the parking?
I love that. So give me some names. Give me some familiar names, some of the people who are coming that we may have heard of before.
Sure. So I'm really excited about a lot of the Mexican food that we have coming. So Gorilla Taco, which I guess, you know, is not traditional Mexican food, but they're a great taco vendor that parks in a different place. Wes Avila is the chef, and we're really excited that we're going to be his Sunday spot. But then we also have Carnitas El Momo, which is
I love them.
Insane carnitas vendor from Boyle Heights. We're really excited to have Smorgasburg be their Sunday spot.
And what about some New York transplants?
Yeah, I'm really excited about Big Mott's, which is one of our sort of legacy Smorgasburg vendors who does handmade mozzarella, but then turns it into mozzarella sticks. Who doesn't love mozzarella sticks, right? And then we also have, like you mentioned, Ramen Burger, as well as Red Hook Lobster Pound, which is one of the best lobster rolls in the country. And then Goa Taco is another one that I'm excited about, which does Indian-style tacos wrapped in paratha instead of a tortilla.
Give us more local names.
All right, local stuff. Khalifa's Taco, the new concept from Esdras Ochoa, the chef of Mexicali Taco and just opened Salazar in Frogtown. Khalifa's is his new taco concept that's basically like grilled carne asada tacos topped with French fries. And then this sauce that is his kind of play on a cross between the Mario's Peruvian green sauce and the marinade in Dino's chicken and burgers. So for anybody who's been
it's like an LA love child.
It is an LA love child on like basically a Mexicali taco with French fries. I'm super excited about that.
What about Asian food?
Oh, yeah. We have tons of Asian stuff. There's one thing called Kalen Kitchen that's a Filipino rice bowl concept. So they use like heritage rice from the Philippines and are doing like their own longanisa and some like really great like stews and stuff that I'm pretty excited about.
Well, it's very exciting. It's nice to see something new happen in such a big way.
Yes, I am super excited. I moved here from New York, God, it's probably now 7 years ago, and I was always a big fan of Brooklyn Flea and Smorgasburg, and I am not only super excited to like help them come to LA, but also to make sure that it is very much of LA, right? Like it's not just some sort of like New York thing.
We've been talking with Zach Brooks, market manager for Smorgasburg LA. Check it out every Sunday at the Alameda Produce Market. We've got lots of photos of that food on Instagram too. Just search for KCRW Good Food. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com via iTunes or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Lara Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.